call.
Let's get this.
What?
I'm just wondering, sorry, I'm late. I was told to get here at 6:15. I'm going to talk a little bit about the consumer's point of view on this issue. As eaters, what our role is, what are the politics of our choices. I come to this subject, I'm not an expert on food, except insofar as I've been eating for 47 years. But I have written a series of articles that basically involve some detective work following the food chain. You may have seen some of these pieces. Most of them were in the New York Times Magazine. I grew some genetically modified potatoes and followed them to the laboratory and to the farms where they're grown. I followed an organic TV dinner from a Whole Foods freezer case back to the six different states where this thing was grown and assembled. And I wrote the biography of a steer that I bought to look at the meat system in America, how you make an industrial steak. And I bought this beef cow from a rancher in South Dakota, and he never moved to my house or anything, but he stayed on the ranch and went to the feedlot and then the slaughterhouse, and I kind of followed him from insemination to slaughter to learn how an industrial steak gets made. And now I'm doing some work on corn, which in a way is the most illegible food chain of all. I mean, Americans are, we don't think of it this way, but we are as dependent on corn for our diet as a Mexican peasant is. We just don't see it because our corn is normally passed through the digestive tract of animals before we eat it. That's the wrong answer.
You know what I mean.
And also we're getting it in our processed food. A quarter of the products in your supermarket have corn in them in one form or another, but you wouldn't know it because it's corn starch and it's high fructose corn syrup is a big part of the American diet at this point. Something like 10% of our calories now come from corn syrup, more for children. So we're in this, so I'm trying to follow corn from the farm through the Cargill or ADM to our supermarket, and that's proving to be very difficult. So anyway, that's where I come from. But before I talk about food and food choice, I want to talk about another consumer item or two, and the first is illicit drugs. One of the most interesting advertising campaigns around right now, I think, is this campaign that the drug office of the government has on about if you buy illicit drugs, you're supporting terrorism. It's a very heavy-handed ad campaign. I'm sure you've seen it at some point on television and in print. It made a strong impression on me. And at first I thought it was kind of, heavy-handed, sleazy kind of advertising approach. But then something else came up that you may have also seen in the news, although it never made it to air, which is taking their tip from that, some people who were very critical of SUVs created an advertisement with a similar idea. If you drive an SUV, you are supporting terrorism. And the logic there is because your petrodollars are supporting these tyrannies in the Middle East, and that is leading to Al-Qaeda. And this ad was not allowed on the air. The drug ads were allowed on the air. And I thought that was very interesting. And I think what really happened was the government and certainly the TV networks finally recognized just how radical it is to look at things this way. And my guess is the TV networks realize as soon as you go down this road of explaining what a purchasing decision means in terms of the larger world, the context, the political context of the dollars you spend, suddenly a huge question mark appears above every consumer item that you could possibly buy. And you pass beyond passive consumerism into something a lot more complicated, more active, and potentially quite radical. You've really thrown into doubt, and this is why I think we never saw those ads, the orthodoxy of our age, which, you know, this market populism, it's been called, which holds that the proper measure of all public decisions is whether it's good or bad for the consumer. And the consumer judges what is good or bad in the most narrow possible way. Does it taste good? Do I like the way it makes me feel? Does it suit my interests in the most narrow way? And this is basically how we've been looking at things and been taught to look at things, I think, really since the Reagan years. I mean, I think there was that key moment in the 1980 election where Reagan, at a debate, turned to the audience and said, "Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago at the Carter administration?" And what he meant by better off was in a very narrow consumerist sense. Do you have more money in your pocket? Is your savings worth more? And ever since, that's really become the the measure of many things. It's the economy, stupid. I mean, all our politicians since have been in that world. So anyway, I think that our political system and our market system are very, to a considerable extent, based on not making such connections between our consumer dollars and between what we drive or eat and nature, the environment, or even national security. Keeping a polite silence between consumers and producers, because that's really what we're talking about here, the relationship of consumers and producers, is what our economy is to a large extent now about. And there is good reason for this. It keeps politics out of the equation. I don't think there's an accident. Now I'll move back to food, which is the example I know best. I don't think this is an exact accident, because I think this food chain, we are part of the food chain, just like every other creature. And this food chain links us and our biology to the land, to nature. The reason that chain has become so long and obscure and illegible is for this reason. Agribusiness wants it that way. And we know that every time that there's a fight over labeling. Genetically modified food, the industry has fought long and hard to keep those labels off our food. Irradiation, enormous fight, although that is being labeled. But what would it be called? Would it be called irradiation, or would it be called something nicer, like the term they're pushing now is cold pasteurization? One of the great euphemisms. I mean, it's technically true, but it creates a very different picture. It borrows the wholesomeness of milk and brings it to radiation. The whole regime of world trade has got a very strong, the WTO has a very strong prejudice against labeling, against telling people how food, you're not allowed to discriminate in world trade on the basis of how something is produced. The means of production is not relevant. And in fact, that's why something like labels over dolphin-safe tuna. This gives connections to the whole World Trade Organization. And in fact, there are moves afoot now to make it even harder to put labels about modes of production on food. And that this will be the next big meeting in Cancun. We'll be dealing with labeling issues. So I can't emphasize enough how important I think labels and about how things are produced. That's what those ads were about, the SUV ads, the drug ads. They were about this term that's sort of fallen out of favor in general discourse, although probably at Berkeley you still hear it, but about the means of production. That's what that was all about. And you're not supposed to talk about it. There's a quote I really like from Wendell Berry about this. He says that the global economy institutionalizes a global ignorance in which producers and consumers cannot know or care about one another, and in which the history of all products will be lost. In such a circumstance, the degradation of products and places, producers and consumers, is inevitable. Because the very short path from not knowing who produced your food or who consumed the food you produced to not caring. And that goes both ways. That's true on the part of the producers, since the farmers, the industrial farmers I've talked to, they don't have a sense that they're growing corn for us to eat or potatoes for us to eat. They're growing for the Cargill or the ADM or the grain elevator. And they have completely lost track of us, which I always find very interesting. If you ask a farmer who is a customer, an organic farmer will tell you, and indeed that's the strength of organic farming as a business has been, it was one of the few segments of American agriculture that fixed on the consumer and tried to talk to the consumer. Very, very few other farmers do that anymore. And there's good reason for that. And the caring goes the other way too, of course. In our purchase decisions, we don't care because we don't see it about the farmer, the farm worker, or the animal in the factory farm. It's just too far away. And it's beyond the range of our sympathies. The Happy Meal, the McDonald's Happy Meal, which is not a very happy meal, is a sterling example of this, of the invisibility, and that's what this piece, maybe in the question period we can talk about it. I don't want to go into great detail about it, but my beef cow, taught me a lot about what was really involved in consuming industrial meat, just how expensive a 99-cent hamburger is. That to make that hamburger so cheap, to make meat something people could consume once or twice a day, something that you said just happened on Sundays in affluent households, to get there took an enormous expense in terms of damage to our health, damage to the environment, in terms of fossil fuel consumption, in terms of humanity and the way we treat these, the degradation of both the animals and the workers involved in producing that steak. The motto of our food system really ought to be cheap at any price. That's the lesson that keeps coming back as you look at the industrial food system, cheap at any price. Another wiser motto, of course, is everything's connected, and what you feed cows and what drugs you administer to cows, you are feeding to the person buying the meat, the child at the other end of that happy meal. So those of you who make your purchase decisions based on factors other than price, or more accurate way to put it, the real price of food, those of you who take a broader view of the cost of things, whether it's a hamburger or a seemingly overpriced organic apple, you're part of a revolt of consumers and small producers against this system. And that revolt begins when consumers stop thinking of yourselves as just consumers. I've always thought that of all the identities we have, we have many different identities, but this was our meanest one, our basest one, is the consumer. But as I've watched the food system over the last couple of years and see it change in some significant ways, I realize that actually it doesn't have to be that way. The passive consumer, the consumer who only cares about price and taste and his or her narrow self-interest, this is a character beloved of business in Washington. And it has been one of the triumphs of free market thinking, I think, since Reagan, to redefine the public interest as simply whatever the public is interested in buying. And under this convenient formulation, the consumer trumps the citizen. Remember that old character, that other character? And the corporation can pretty much do what it wants so long as it enjoys the consent of the shopper. And the measure of all public decisions becomes, is it good for the economy, for the consumer? And we see this now with Arctic drilling, worker safety, air quality, the war, you name it. But I think what the architects of this market populism, this idea, could never have foreseen is that the sharp distinction between consumer and citizen would start to blur. And I really think that's happening, at least in the food area. That the citizen, that kind of recherché character, might show up at the supermarket, the car dealership, the university dining hall, one day. And I think that he and she is doing that. So I think that's one of the really important things going on in the food area. I'm an optimist. Is the rehabilitation of that character, the consumer, and the bringing of the values of citizenship to the consumer's decision. I have seen it in food. I mean, you see it with the organic food market. I mean, this is an industry now, $7 billion, that was built in the face of indifference and hostility from the Department of Agriculture, from business. And now it's here. There's a lot of issues with it being co-opted, but it is here, and it was established by consumers, by and large. Consumers talking to producers and producers talking to consumers. In the narrower sense, I have seen the power of consumers to get changes in the food industry. McDonald's, you know, one of the peculiar things about the food industry is that it's touchy. I mean, they're dealing with a product that is so intimate and that we have such strong feelings about and affects our children that food scare them. And genetic engineering was an example where this was a product that a lot of consumers have misgivings about. And when word got out that McDonald's was, people didn't really realize they were eating genetically modified food a couple years ago. A lot of people still don't know. And there were some articles published saying that McDonald's was buying these genetically modified potatoes, and if you've eaten at McDonald's or Frito-Lay, you've eaten genetically modified potatoes. However you think about it, you may not want to do it, but you're not given a choice. There's no label. Well, McDonald's had signed on to genetically modified potatoes. Monsanto wouldn't launch the product until they did, actually, and Monsanto spent a lot of time persuading them that the consumer will have no problem with this, and they worked out these marketing studies in Canada that showed consumers wouldn't care. Well, McDonald's got a bunch of phone calls. Not a lot. I never found out exactly how many, but it was well under 100. It was probably 25, 50 phone calls from people saying, "Is this true? Are you really selling genetically modified potatoes and not telling us?" And within a year, they stopped buying genetically modified potatoes. They didn't make a big announcement about it. And then within one more year, without McDonald's, the industry collapsed, and genetically modified potatoes are no longer on the market because McDonald's was responsible for 7% of the potato crop. So this is one of the virtues of bigness. It can give you some leverage as a consumer. I told that story to someone who's involved in these issues in England, and he told me he knew on very good authority, he's the head of the Soil Association there, that 10 letters to McDonald's that were not organized, or did not appear to be organized, was enough to get, on the same subject, was enough to get a subject on the agenda at the board of directors meeting. Isn't that amazing? 10? So there's a lot of leverage in that. Another great example, and this involves McDonald's also, but other companies as well. See, McDonald's, they're the bad guys, and they're in some ways the good guys. After a lot of pressure from consumers and animal rights groups, they almost overnight reformed the slaughter practices in this country and made it considerably more humane. It's nowhere near what it needs to be, but the point is that they respond to pressure. All these big companies do if it's well organized. So well organized, it doesn't appear to be organized. But of course, there's a great old American tradition here. You know, there were food boycotts. I mean, don't go back way past the 60s. I mean, it was a big thing in the 60s, lettuce and grapes. But it actually goes back to slavery. The abolitionists organized protests against sugar because it was grown with slave labor, and no one on the East Coast would deign to eat cane sugar. It was considered, you know, just not PC. So this is an American idea with some deep roots. That's to give you an idea of the power of a little bit of knowledge. Imagine a lot of knowledge about the food chain. There's one country that has done that, has imagined that, and I offer this as a kind of thought experiment. There's a program in a couple supermarket chains in Denmark where the products in the stores have two barcodes instead of one. And you can take your package, say, of lamb chops up to a scanner located around the store, and run it under the scanner, and on the TV screen right there will come all you could possibly want to know about that lamb chop, including images of the farm where it was grown, the feed that it got, was it on grass, did it get pain, did it get any drugs, the day it was slaughtered, the place it was slaughtered, it's all there. And it's there for all the chickens and the beef, and I don't know if it's true of the vegetables. Excuse me?
Is that an American case?
Well, just imagine if we did what you could not do. What would just not be permissible. I mean, feedlots would disappear overnight. You just couldn't do it under that system, which is why we won't ever have that system. But well, I think it's a very powerful image of the power of this kind of knowledge, and that it is suggested is worth fighting for. The other what? Oh, for the price, the normal stuff, inventory, price, when you check out. So anyway, all by way of saying, this knowledge is very powerful. There is a role for legislation, there is a role for the government in this. The whole food system will not be reformed only by consumers. But ferreting out the story, and the real story, because there's a lot of fictional stories now appearing on food labels. They understand the game. They understand that people like stories about their food. And there are not a lot of rules to keep them from not telling the truth about, you know, the rancher. You know, you'll soon see pictures of ranchers on packages of hamburger. So ferreting out the real story is very important. But it's energy well spent when you're shopping, when you're thinking about what you're going to buy. That the consumer is not just a consumer. The consumer doesn't just take in, does not just use the world, does not just consume the world, but creates the world. And with your consumer decisions, you can every time you're making a decision on what to buy, you can foster one kind of agriculture and not another, one idea of our relationship to nature and not another, one kind of food chain and not another. So I encourage you to shop with that sort of consciousness. Thank you very much.
Is Rick Young here yet?
Okay.
Thank you all for coming out, and thank you to the Free Speech Movement Cafe Educational Programs Committee. I feel very conscious of the need to say thank you, because I'm going to be making you all very miserable. In contrast, perhaps, to Michael's sort of empowered shopper vision, I'm going to be talking more about I'm going to be talking about the Horsemen of the Apocalypse. I'm going to be talking about famine, about war, about death, and possibly pestilence a little later on. The reason I'm talking about this is because I'm going to be talking about hunger in the third world. Hunger in the third world that happens as a result of things that are sponsored by, not by consumer decisions, but by citizenship decisions, by things that your government does in your name. Now, I mean, when citizens in the US hear about people who don't have food, you know, they inevitably appear on our television screens, projected by a media that is hungry for the next sensational story. And embedded in that image is a question, and the question is this: what shall we do for these people? Now, asking what shall we do for these starving people already misrepresents the situation. It makes it seem, when we see these images on our screen, we're encouraged to be sort of amnesiac. We're encouraged to forget what's going on just to the side of the screen and what has happened in order to make people so debilitated, so poor, that they, you know, their bodies have been been systematically deprived of food to the extent that they look the way they do on our television screens. But when we ask, what should we do for these people, it makes it seem as if we, the privileged in the first world, the developed world, the imperialist world, or call it what you will, that we are blameless, that we are witness to a tragedy upon which we have only recently stumbled. and in whose genesis we are entirely innocent. But we're not innocent. And I want, I mean, basically what I'm going to do in this talk is show how we are not innocent, how we are not innocent, and even though we are citizens in this country, or some of us might not be, that a great deal of violence is being done in our name by evoking the idea of an American citizenship. And in order to be able to do that, let's take a step back from that image. The image that's often plays in people's consciousness is the idea of starving African child. And it's very interesting to unpack that, the idea of the way Africa is represented on the television screens in the United States as a childlike nation, a nation that is not quite, a continent that is not quite able to take care of itself, that needs paternalism, that is has not quite reached the ability to reason for itself, and that is benign but not yet fully formed. That's that racist representation of Africa is one that plays on, that solicits our compassion, that makes us feel like we're going to be doing good if we send food over, for example. But let's take a step back from that image and figure out exactly what a famine is. I'm going to throw some numbers at you very quickly, just to give you an idea of the official definition of famine, and then we can move on from that. The official definition of a famine is this, quote, "The severity of critical malnutrition levels are greater than 15% of children." And that's the Food and Agricultural Organization's definition of a famine. But the definition of a famine is a threshold idea that once you trip past 15%, then you're in a situation of famine. But what happens when you're at 14% or 13% of malnutrition, or 11 or 10? In southern Africa at the moment, there are 14 million people who are at risk of starvation. And what I want to suggest is this, that the reason that they have finally been brought to a situation of famine is because they have been going hungry for the past 10 years. Famine doesn't just happen overnight. Famine is the result of a systematic onslaught of policies that essentially have been authored in this country, in your name. The idea that, as I say, famine doesn't happen overnight. It's a chronic and systematic process. In Zambia, for example, which is now made the official famine list, in 1991, the stunting rate of children was 39%, and now it's leveled off at 55%. In 1991, the increase from 39% to 55%, and finally to the level where there is official famine, took 10 years. Before that, but we're only hearing about it just now. We're only seeing it on the television screens today. But it's a process that's been happening for 10 years. We need to think historically, in other words. When we see the image on the television screen, we're encouraged to think this sort of thing happened just yesterday, just by magic. But it didn't. It's been going on systematically in southern Africa. The recent famine has its origins at least 10 years ago. Now, thinking historically is desperately useful. And for those who are interested in it, I can recommend no book more than Mike Davis's book, Late Victorian Holocausts. And in this book, he comes up with some amazing statistics. When the British took over India, they arrived and they saw the Indian villages, and they saw that the system of ownership and production was feudal, and they thought this was hopelessly backward, the British are wont to do. And they decided that the idea that feudal landlords distributing food to people in times of need was actually a way of encouraging laziness. And so they set about uprooting that social system and replacing it with their more enlightened one of capitalist free market economics. decide, and they did this ostensibly for the most benign reasons. They thought, well, you know, works in Britain, it's got to work here, and it's, you know, it's a way of really getting the hungry off their feet and, you know, working for their food, and that's got to be a jolly good thing, hasn't it? Well, oddly enough, the results were disastrous, and I'll tell you quite how disastrous they were a little later on. But those who were campaigning for independence in India were given ammunition by the British. In the prestigious British Journal of the Journal of the British Statistical Society, there's this really, really important fact. I'll say it very slowly. The British Journal of the Statistical Society found out that in the 120 years that Britain had ruled India, there had been 31 serious famines. 120 years, 31 famines. But in the previous 2,000 years, there had been only 17 famines. Now, the lesson to take away from this is that there's, you know, it's not that feudalism is hopelessly backward. In fact, it has within it a mechanism for redistributing food. Now, I'm not advocating going back to feudalism, but what I am saying is that the free market is dangerous. In fact, the free market kills people. The free market in the 19th century killed 40 million people in the Third World. That's the death toll of all the systematic famines that happened throughout the 1800s, 1800s. And that happened not because people were hopelessly backward, but because they were being incorporated into the world capitalist system. Now, in the rest of my talk, I guess I want to talk about the solutions that are being offered. I want you to go away with an image. And the image is the image from Monty Python's The Time Bandits. I don't know if have people seen Time Bandits here. Did that ever make it? For those of you who didn't, there's a scene in the film that deeply and effectively encapsulates what food aid and what the current sort of food aid regime looks like. And the scene is this. The Time Bandits are sort of floating through time, and they drop into the middle of Sherwood Forest, and they've just robbed Napoleon, and they've got a whole bunch of booty. And they get approached by Robin Hood. Robin Hood is the upper-class twit of the year. And he's just sort of, oh, hello, I'm Hood. Hello. Oh, yes, come and meet the poor. Have you met them? They're awfully nice. Of course, they don't have two pennies to rub together, but that's because they're poor and marvellous people. And the scene is this, that the Time Bandits sort of lined up, and the poor come along, and they shake the hand of the Time Bandits, and they shake the hand of Robin Hood, and Robin Hood will give them a painting or, you know, some jewellery. And then standing next to Robin Hood is Marian. Marian is a character that not made Marian, but a sort of postulant, sort of brutish football player type, who takes back the jewellery, the paintings, and everything, and then punches the poor between the teeth, and then the poor go flying away. And Robin Hood turns to Marian and he says, "Do you have to do that?" And Marian says, "Yeah." Now that image is essentially what the international food aid system looks like, and I mean don't take Monty Python's word for it. Here's a quote from the United States Agency for International Development. And this is what the USAID, the world's largest aid agency, international food aid agency, has to say for itself. They said this in 1997. "The principal beneficiary of America's foreign assistance has always been the United States. Foreign assistance programs have helped the United States by creating major markets for agricultural goods, new markets for industrial exports, and hundreds of thousands of jobs for Americans." Well, I mean, you might say, well, there's nothing wrong with that, clearly. I mean, American jobs are priorities for Americans. And if we're talking about agriculture and food, then it's a good thing that small family farms, which are desperately important to American rural communities, are being supported by the U.S. government. But of course, the small family farms aren't benefiting from USAID at all. It's the large, hulking, made Marion-type corporations that are benefiting from US, from the things that your government is doing in your name. So, for example, last year, the government passed the 2002 U.S. Farm Bill, which gives $180 billion in new subsidies to U.S. agriculture. And you might think, oh, well, fantastic, $180 billion for small family farms. But 47% of that $180 billion is going to farms with average household incomes of $135,000 a year. The poor aren't benefiting from this in the United States, and they certainly aren't benefiting from this in the third world. I mean, and the European Union, I should say, this is not America bashing, this is capitalist bashing, because the EU are no better. In the European Union, cows, for example, every cow is subsidized to the tune of $2 a day. $2, that's more than tens of millions of households across the world earn, and this is money going into hamburgers. And in the EU, for example, they have sugar monopolies. Sugar monopolies cost European taxpayers $1.5 billion a year. So they have a sugar support regime that goes to support sugar monopolies, while the countries in the south that produce sugar are shut out of the market. Mozambique, for example, a country that produces sugar, has lost a chance to earn roughly $100 million a year through its sugar, through potential sugar exports. And that's because the European Union is subsidizing its own sugar monopolies, its own sugar corporations. Now, you might feel we're drifting a little here. You might feel that we're not really talking about the starving in Africa. But of course we are. The food system has been commodified and then systematically dominated by unfair trade agreements like the World Trade Organization, as Michael mentioned, and huge subsidies to corporations in the first world. While at the same time, the third world is being told to cut back on its subsidies to farmers, to prevent support for rural communities, to structurally adjust itself. You might think, well, maybe the real issue really isn't trade treaties or World Bank loans. Perhaps you think there's just not enough food being produced in Africa, for example. And again, you'd be wrong. In every famine that has happened since the end of the Second World War, the issue is not that the food isn't there. There has always been food. The issue is that people are too poor to afford it. Now, I could be talking about genetically modified food. Maybe we can talk about that in questions if people are interested in GM food. But I guess what I want to talk about now really is the war. Because the mentality that drives USAID is the mentality that drives the United States government's food policy in the Middle East. Now, even before the reconstruction in Iraq has begun, capitalism is hard at work. The president recently authorized a shipment of 50,000 tons of wheat from the United States to Iraq. The shipment is scheduled to leave sometime this week, and it'll get there within a month. And on the face of it, there seems to be nothing wrong with that. The people of Iraq are hungry, and they need food. But of course, again, we've got to remember there's some history here. Remember why they are hungry. The sanctions against Iraq have killed over 500,000 children. The people of Iraq have been reduced to abject poverty. And yet, food was available in Baghdad until the day the bombs started to fall. And some correspondents are still filing stories about how food is available. This is an example of how U.S. corporations are being subsidized. I mean, the food isn't coming from anywhere else in the region. It's coming from the Mississippi Delta. It's coming, and the money that is going to pay for this will end up in the pockets of Archer Daniels Midland and the big grain shipment companies. It's not even farmers in the Middle East who are going to be able to, at some level, profit from the war. The people who profit from the war are the corporations here. and that's nuts. I don't mean to sort of belabor this, but it is rather insane. For example, Tunisia exported 200,000 tons of wheat in the year 2000. 200,000 tons of wheat. And yet the average income in Tunisia is less than $2,000 a head. You don't think that they might have, for example, been able to get the grain to Iraq slightly quicker. Or Turkey even, which exported over 2 million tons in the year 2000. I mean, the fact that the US is brazen enough to ship its grain from the Mississippi to Iraq and put it in the same convoy lines that supply ammunition, while even in the region there are farmers who are hungry, it beggars the imagination. And this is what is being done in your name. This is what is being done, I don't want to detract from Michael's point, but this is something over which consumer sovereignty has no purchase. But this is something that is being done because you are citizens, or rather, because you are citizens. Here's something that's being done in your name, with your consent. And that shouldn't be allowed. Enlightened a fashion we shop, as Michael said, that's part of the story. But the other part of the story is getting out into the streets, is actually making a real difference, not through the dollars that you spend at the supermarket counter, but the dollars that are taken out of your paycheck and used as ammunition against the people of the third world. I don't know. We could talk about the war in Iraq and the way in which food has been used as a weapon throughout the third world until the cows come home. But I do, I suppose, want to end with a more positive note. I mean, there are things we can do. As Michael said, becoming consumer activists is a step forward. Supporting local agriculture rather than the large corporations is through CSAs, for example, community support in agriculture. Go to your local farmers market. That's important. But with this war, it's important to take to the streets. Come to there's a big march in Oakland tomorrow, and we need to be out there. In terms more directly of food politics, join Food First. That's a little, it's a wee plug. Thanks, Mum. We have a table back there somewhere. Over there by the entrance, and the list going around. If you're interested, if you're interested in getting engaged in these sort of politics, because the sorts of food aid politics that USAID do are done in your name, and it's important to fight them. It's important to fight it on as many fronts as you can. Thanks very much.
So I'm going to pull this one.
You can just put him at the end there.
Is he here? And I just don't see
him. He's here. He's coming all right.
Oh, there he is.
Here comes Rick.
There we go. I apologize for arriving late. I just finished up a month-long trial just a couple hours ago and came straight here. I'm here to talk about the initiative that I wrote and that the citizens of Berkeley voted on a few months back. I don't know if anybody here voted on the coffee law. Hopefully you voted yes. But essentially how it all started was I saw a cartoon one day. It said, "Excuse me, waiter, there's the blood and misery of 1,000 small farmers in my coffee." And there's a woman pointing to her coffee cup, and that kind of got me reading and interested in this coffee issue. I drink a lot of coffee, and I think that people should be responsible in their purchases. And so I became more interested in these coffee issues. Now, there's an organization called Transfair, and they certify fair trade coffee, that if you buy coffee in this shop, for example, it's only fair trade organic coffee, and that's great. and they're located in Oakland, so they get a lot of local press. So while I was in law school here at Berkeley a few years ago, I was reading about this, and I got thinking about it, and I thought, wow, you know, maybe we should get our law school coffee shop to carry fair trade coffee or shade-grown coffee or organic coffee. Now, let me just explain what those categories are, because there's a lot of different types of coffee. Coffee prices right now are really, really low, and small-time farmers are really struggling. Coffee prices have dropped right now to like the lowest level, when adjusted for inflation, lowest level in like 100 years. And this is coming about because there's a lot of very large-scale coffee being produced on a large scale, you know, the mass agriculture. And when they grow it this way, what they generally do is just clear cut out rainforest, just plant coffee, grow it in the sun. You have to put a lot of chemicals on it. Workers be treated very badly. It's horrible for the environment. You know, obviously you're removing all this rainforest. You have to apply lots of chemicals. It's bad for the the animals. It's bad for the workers. The way coffee traditionally is grown is it's grown in the rainforest under the trees. That's why coffee normally grows. That's why sometimes coffee is referred to as shade-grown coffee when it's grown under the trees. That's the natural way. So there's a couple of different categories. When something is certified as shade-grown, they look at a whole list of categories and a whole list of criteria and determine that to get the seal of approval, it has to be grown under the trees without chemicals and it has to pass a whole range of criteria. Organic just simply means no chemicals, and it almost is always shade grown, but not necessarily. Now, fair trade coffee, the folks in Transfer from Oakland, what they'll do is certify that the farmer's being paid a good wage for the coffee, a good price for the coffee, and it's coming from a small farmer. It doesn't have to be organically grown or shade grown, but it almost always is. The small farmers, that's the way they traditionally grow it. So they're all a little bit different, but they're all much, much better than just coffee that you get when you don't know how it's been produced. So they're all good categories. So going back to law school, we approached the owner of the person who ran the law school coffee shop, which ironically enough is the man who runs this cafe. It's kind of funny that I'm here. We approached him and said, we think you should carry nothing but fair trade coffee or organic coffee or a good coffee. And he said, well, you know, we used to carry an organic coffee, but it cost a little extra and people wouldn't buy it, so we just canceled it. Well, we said, well, maybe you should take away that option. Just give people nothing but the good stuff. And he refused. So we said, okay, what we're going to do is boycott your coffee shop. And we're not stupid enough to think that law students are going to stop drinking coffee. We're going to give away free fair trade coffee. And no one will buy your coffee. No one will come into your shop. So he told us to drop dead. And we got the stuff together. And the very day, it was much of a coincidence, the very day we got it all together, he switched over. So I can't really say the boycott. It was a threat of the boycott, I think, that made it work. So I was thinking, boy, that was a lot of work. It'd be great if we could get everybody to do this, but it's just simply too much trouble to give away free coffee to everybody in Berkeley. So I thought, could you pass a law that makes people sell? If they're going to sell coffee, it'd have to be a good coffee. And I started thinking, well, you know, we do that with gas. You know, you can't just sell any gas. You have to sell unleaded gas. And I was taking a class on local laws and what you can do with local laws, and I found out you can do this, actually. So I wrote a paper on it and didn't really do much about it. I got a kind of like an average grade on the paper. Just started thinking, you know, this would be really kind of an interesting thing. And then I don't know exactly what happened, but I decided I was going to do this. I was really going to do this. I'm going to see if I can get the city council to pass this. Now, the city council is sympathetic in some ways. They say the city of Berkeley, when their departments are going to serve coffee, like, you know, the planning commission meets or somebody, that's supposed to be fair trade coffee only. So the city, when they purchase their own coffee, I think they were the first city in the United States to do that. There's some other cities that do that now. But this was going to go, you know, big step beyond and say, if you're selling coffee in Berkeley, it's got to be fair trade, shade grown, organic. So I wrote up this proposal, wrote the law out, and presented to the city council, and nobody was interested. So they talked about it for a little while, but nobody took it too seriously. So I thought, okay, well, I'll just collect signatures and put it on the ballot. So went out to the farmers market, sat in front of supermarkets and things, and collected, I don't know, about 3,000 signatures. And some other people helped me out, and so we got on the ballot. And it started getting a lot of press. Now, I kind of figured it would get some press. That was partially why I did this. I thought, you know, if this thing passes, that's wonderful. But even if it doesn't, I suspect it'll get people thinking about their purchases, get people thinking about being a citizen, not just a consumer. You can decide what happens in your town. You don't have to just passively take what they sell you. It just sparked some thought. But it kind of was crazy. It went, some of the local papers carried it. Then the next day was a local TV carried it. And then the next day was like CNN called me. And I was like, oh, this is crazy. And it got a lot of press, was in the New York Times and things like that. So hopefully, I don't know that they were just covering this because it's crazy Berkeley things. I'd like to think that maybe they're thinking that there was something good about this, and maybe it was the start of a trend. But it did get a lot of press, and hopefully people did think about it. It also attracted quite a bit of opposition from the coffee companies, and the the Chamber of Commerce organized a committee against this measure, and Starbucks and Peet's and the National Coffee Association each dumped in about $10,000 a piece. So they put together a pretty good little kitty of money to fight this. Now, one of the problems with the law, I have to admit, it's all my fault, is that when I was drafting the law, I thought, well, we have to make a penalty. I was copying this law for the most part from this old recycling law in Berkeley, and this recycling law made the penalty a misdemeanor. A misdemeanor gives the penalty up to 6 months in jail or a fine or both. So I thought, well, if that's worked for that, I better not change it, because I didn't know what I was doing. It's the first law I ever drafted. I didn't want to make a penalty that, like, could cause a problem, so I thought, if it worked, that'll work here. So I made it a misdemeanor, so there was a possible jail term. Now, I just want to point out my defense. Riding a bicycle on the sidewalk or having an unauthorized barbecue on city property also is a misdemeanor, and you could be thrown in jail for 6 months, but of course it doesn't happen. Nevertheless, the opponents really seized on that, and serve the wrong cup of coffee, go to jail, was the message that went out. And actually, this is the flyer that all citizens of Berkeley got. Does the punishment fit the crime? Man being taken off in handcuffs. And I thought, well, I don't think I'd vote for this thing. Measure O means 6 months in jail for a cup of coffee. So, and then they also say it's a poorly written measure that'll end up costing Berkeley more than $100,000 in enforcement costs each year, although the city never said that. So they took it somewhat seriously, I guess. Starbucks and Peet's will say, oh, we support these coffees, you think it's a great thing. Starbucks actually is the largest purchaser of fair trade in America because they make it available. And their kind of arms were kind of twisted to get them to do that, and they serve brewed cups of coffee of fair trade once a month or so. And that alone makes them, you know, the biggest fair trade supporter. My personal opinion is they're not that interested in making certain that the coffee farmers are being treated well, the environment's taken care of. I'll be a little cynical here, just some posturing so they can say, how can you blame us? Like, we're the best. We serve the most.
Like putting 100 flyers and brochures in front of the shop that say, free trade.
So, they'll putting, a lot of money into this, fighting this, but yet they're trying to pretend that they're the biggest supporter. So, election day rolled around, and we lost. So it wasn't too close, actually. It was about 70%, 30%. But I thought, maybe it was still a good thing. It got some people thinking. I've actually rewritten it and submitted it to the city council. I took out the jail term, and I just dropped it down to a fine. And just so people are clear, it's only the brewed coffee. We weren't trying to change, we were trying to take baby steps here, not say all coffee. And then I also proposed, we could restrict it to just big corporations and chains, corporate chains in Berkeley and stuff. So I submitted that to city council. They're still not that interested. So you never know. We may collect signatures and put it on the ballot again. But I was pleased they got a lot of publicity. I hope it got people thinking. I was contacted from a number of different people in different cities. And there was a couple cities, Oklahoma and one in Ohio that were taking steps along the same lines. I don't think they were having a whole lot of luck either, unfortunately. But hopefully it got people thinking. But I think it was important that people realized that, you don't just have to take what these shops give you. It's important that people realize, that they can control if they get enough voters, how these corporations operate. We don't have to just sit here and let them serve products that have a horrible impact on other people and have a horrible impact on the environment. A lot of people are like, you know, who are you to tell me what coffee to serve, but or what coffee I can buy, or, you know, and I think that when it, you know, if you make a decision that affects you and only you, maybe it's your business. If you want to ride around on a motorcycle with no helmet, you crash, you die, that's okay. But, you know, when you make these purchases, you really do affect people beyond yourself. And you affect the environment, you affect everyone's environment, you affect people all over the world. So I thought that this is something that people should take responsibility for. And, you know, if it, you know, people said, oh, I was like a Nazi in Germany in the 1930s, somebody wrote me an email. And, you know, I was like, okay, but I didn't know Hitler was, you know, into the birds, but yeah, people have to, you know, okay, you do give up a little bit. You give up some of your coffee choices. It might cost a few pennies extra, but I really think that that's not a whole lot to sacrifice when you kind of consider the big picture. So if you see me sitting out in front of the supermarket in a few years, next year or something, please consider signing the petition. Thanks very much.
Well, we're now opening this up to questions. I'm going to circulate the microphone so everybody can hear. And
anybody want to start? Is that first question? Are there any questions? Okay. Can somebody walk us back there? I'm so stuck. It helps for the recording. You know, the USA Patriot Act requires that we monitor all conversations.
Can you hear me now? I actually had a question directed towards Michael Pollan. Hi. We're actually doing a group project on labeling, the labeling issue with organic food and genetically engineered food. And I guess my question is mostly directed towards what do you see happening in the future in terms of labeling of genetically engineered food, if at all? Do you see it happening? Because our research is mostly based on what kind of choices consumers have. And it seems like we really don't have a lot around genetically modified food. So what do you see happening with that?
Well, you know, there was an effort in Oregon that went down, same election cycle as yours, and got on the ballot to require labeling of any genetically modified food sold in the state of Oregon. And I don't, does anyone remember what the vote was?
It was not good.
Yeah, not good.
Probably better than mine.
And I was actually surprised it wasn't better, and I haven't studied it too closely. I do know that the industry took it very, very seriously, and there was a big advertising campaign against it. There is no reason, you know, the FDA, the government won't do it. It'll come from ballot initiatives and that sort of thing if it's going to happen. There's a funny distinction between radiated food. Irradiated food is labeled. The same logic should apply. The argument against labeling genetically modified food is the FDA has said it is substantially equivalent to other food, and you only have to do a label if, you know, there's no argument based on the fact that you can make a firm distinction between this food. They also said, though, the same thing, that irradiated food is substantially equivalent. Why did they go with a label there? Just more political pressure. A lot more political pressure. So if it happens, it will be because of political pressure. Do I think it's going to happen? I don't know. I think we've sort of backed into it. People understand that organic is the only way you can really avoid genetically modified food, if you care to do that, is the organic label. And there was an enormous fight over that, as I'm sure you know, when the government, the initial set of standards for organic would have allowed genetically modified food to be called organic, and which was just this outrageous idea. But they were afraid that, you know, they didn't want to discriminate against GMOs in the marketplace. So they put this in, and there was a huge outcry. And so there's an enormous, there is a lot of support for labeling of it. But I think we're going to have this backwards labeling thing that you can, if you care about it, you'll get organic because that's the way to avoid it. I think labeling has, I think it's very, very important. I mean, I've got a lot of problems with the organic regime of labeling. I mean, I think that it's backfiring in certain ways. We saw in the last, it's still going on, but now this word, this incredibly powerful word, and I mean powerful in the sense that it has won the respect of consumers, is now owned by the government. And as soon as that happens, you have a situation where every time there is an appropriations bill for the Department of Agriculture, somebody can slip in a provision that would change the organic standards. And in fact, this just happened. Yeah. And there was a small company, it was a very significant event, I think. Fifedale Farms, a little company in Georgia, went to their congressman, and they wanted to get into the organic market because it's such a good market. But gee, this organic feed is so expensive, and wouldn't it be great if we could get into the organic market and not have to buy this expensive organic feed? So they got their congressman. We learned exactly the price of a congressman in America. It's $4,000. It's all $4,000, and you can get a provision into a bill that said that, well, if organic feed is too expensive, you don't have to buy it, and you can still call it organic. And this is one of these things flipped in late at night, and there was an outcry over it, and it will probably be undone. But there will be, and it's an important fight, because this is the first time that this has happened. There have been a couple other skirmishes. There's one over organic, wild salmon is organic, and Ted Stevens got that written in. So there's a lot of pressure on organic. In fact, organic high fructose corn syrup has just gotten in, and that did not go through any. That was kind of a backdoor, you know, expensive lawyers convinced the Department of Agriculture that that was organic and not processed or not synthetic. So the organic farmers, in a way, have lost control of this word, and there is a great danger that it will be bought and sold like all other regulations. So.
I saw slight comments on this. Bob Kennard, who's one of the main leaders of the organic movement, said that we have to actually change the word and actually leave the word organic and actually describe Bob Kennard. He's a guy who works a lot with Chinese, Paris Waters. He's one of the original supporters of the organic movement. Quite early on, back in about 5 years ago now, said that you have to take back the word organic or actually change it because it's going to be so corrupted.
There are a lot of farmers who are looking for the next word, and there's something called the Beyond Organic Movement, which aims to set the bar on American agriculture again, set it higher. The problem with, you know, most regulations is that, and the weird thing about organic is generally industries want the lowest possible standards. And the government was actually trying to oblige in certain ways by having this very low threshold for organic, and then they were shocked that here was an industry, and only on the part of the farmers, not the processors, but the farmers actually wanted the highest standard possible. And that confounded all the rules of politicking in Washington. It took them a while to get that. But yeah, there are people talking about real food, authentic food, and I think we will need other labels too. And I don't think organic is the last word. The problem is you don't want a situation where there are 10 different labels and some of them are meaningful and some are not, and you have a very confused consumers. But there's also, you know, there's a lot of feeling that issues of social justice, for instance, are not reflected in the organic rules, how you treat your farm workers, the standards for animals, although there are some standards and it does improve the standards for animal welfare, it's certainly not what a lot of farmers want or subscribe to. So there are other labels out there about humane standards. I think there's room for more than one, but I think it's very important that they be certified and backed up. I don't think you need the government to back it up. It isn't really clear that the organic industry needed this. The argument was that there was a lot of fraud and people were selling conventional carrots as organic carrots, but when I looked into it, there was only one or two cases ever where this actually happened.
I just wanted to add to this good discussion a recommendation for a book by Professor Marion Nestle called Food Politics. It was published a year ago at the University of California Press, by the University of California Press, and Professor Nessel spoke a couple of days ago here on the campus, and I was lucky enough to hear her, and she focused her discussion on the epidemic of obesity in America, and why, and the politics of that, why we make the choices we make, having to do with the enormous lobbying efforts, the hand-in-glove relationship between government and industry, the amounts, the billions of dollars spent on ads for eating more, as opposed to a fraction of that spent on nutrition. So I would just recommend that book to you. It would round out the discussion.
It's a terrific book, and she has this very simple idea, which is, and I don't know that it's hers, but that food is different than other consumer goods in that there's a real limit to how much we can eat. You know, people can only eat about 1,500 pounds of the stuff a year. It's only gone up, try as they might. I mean, so they have a couple. So if you have to grow at a faster rate, as a corporation, you have to grow at a faster rate than the rate of population growth. That's a fundamental structural problem in the food industry. How do you get, if population is growing at 2%, and Wall Street is going to insist on more than 10% growth, how do you do it? Well, one is get us all to eat more. And so you have supersized portions, you have all the various strategies to seduce us into eating more. And then the other way to make money is to process food more. Process the industry, the more you study the economics industry, they really live or die by processing because the raw materials are so cheap, partly because they're subsidized, as you were describing, and the commodity prices are always declining. So the only way to do it is make the food more and more complicated. And when processed food sort of fell out of favor after the 60s and the kind of move again, you know, the processed food became associated with all the evils of industrial civilization, the industry has regrouped and they figured out a way to redeem processed food and call it nutraceuticals and functional food and all these, you know, you can buy bread now that, you know, is designed for men or for women with all these different botanicals in it, and it's all organic. But it is a highly processed product. So processing is the other strategy to get us to spend more for the same old 1,500 pounds of chow.
Just to complement that, I mean, while the third world is the dumping ground for primary commodities, in the United States, food production, I mean, one way that the corporations have managed to sort of grow more than the rate of the population is to produce more than actually is needed or that people can afford. And they find themselves in a similar position, you know, just as we have sort of grain mountains in the Mississippi, there are processed food mountains in the United States that are disposed of through food banks. The growth of the food bank in the United States and through community food banks, but food banks and through charity and sort of charitable distribution as part of the sort of volunteerism that supports the big welfare reforms that have happened in the United States. That is directly related to the fact that there's now, you do have the sort of secondary, this market, this glut of processed food and therefore the federal government is subsidizing the secondary producers of food in disposing of that through, let's say, through food banks, through
school lunch and
school lunch. Yes, exactly.
Where does the medical profession weigh in on these issues? Are they concerned about the quality of our food?
I can answer that for Britain, because the British Medical Association has said that the science for genetically modified food has not been done, and therefore they recommend to the government that a moratorium be placed on it until it has. I'm not sure that the American Medical Association is quite so political.
Mary Nessel could answer these questions a lot better. She's a nutritionist by training. I know she's spoken, other people have spoken, just how little nutritional education goes on in say, medical schools. The whole idea of obesity as a therapeutic specialty is relatively new, and there is more interest in it now than there has ever been. But I think that it's gotten very short shrift. And also the other thing that she talks about is the recommendations are highly politicized. If you look at the nutritional guidelines designed by our government, by the National Academy of Sciences, just recently issued, and compare it to the WHO nutritional guidelines, not quite issued, partly because of protests from American companies, they're very different, and they reflect a lot of log rolling. For example, and I'm not sure I'm going to get this quite right, but the American guidelines say that you can get up to 25% of your calories from processed sugar, from refined sugar, simple carbohydrates. And the WHO says it's something like 10%. And so there was a lot of lobbying behind that, to not demonize sugar, to not demonize meat. So I think the medical establishment has basically lost control of that process. And why that is, I don't know.
More? This one, okay. Question over here.
You mentioned earlier that you could talk about genetically modified food in the context of the third world. I forget how long ago it was. I think maybe a month ago, I saw a cover of a magazine, an environmental magazine, and it said, U.S. says to the third world, eat shit or die. And I looked in the, this obviously was interesting to me, and I flipped to the thing where it describes what's on the cover, and it said that U.S. companies or the U.S. Food Aid Organization, I'm not sure which, had offered genetically modified food and it had been rejected. And I think the conclusion was that we were going to go to the World Trade Organization or somebody and protest this because it wasn't fair that we couldn't send our GM food. So I was wondering if you had more detailed information about that.
Yes, the magazine is The Ecologist, and it's a brilliant front cover. America offers Africa a choice: eat shit or die. And it's a sort of revolver pointing out of the cover at you. And what happened was that the United States chartered a ship called the Liberty Star, to take 30,000 tons of corn to meet the famine in Africa. Initially, African country said, well, actually, you know, the science hasn't been done to our satisfaction to prove that this is safe, and it's true. I mean, yeah, there has been no independent testing of genetically modified corn done in the United States. The people who do the testing are Monsanto. Sorry?
Very unbiased people.
Yeah, no. Yes, the food, health, and hope, isn't it? Food, something, and hope is Monsanto's logo. Wonderful. Again, what happened was the country said no, thank you. And in response to that, America mobilized its sort of diplomats. The most interesting example of this is that Colin Powell phoned the Vatican, because Zambia is a largely Christian country, and I think 40% Catholic. And so Colin Powell phoned the Vatican to ask them to intercede to see if they could get, you know, the Vicar of Christ to officially certify genetically modified food. And luckily, he didn't. The screws were put on to African countries. The threat was that aid would be withdrawn, the credit lines at the World Bank and IMF would be refused. By the way, the same IMF that told Malawi to sell its grain reserves 6 months before a famine was actually foreseen to strike, the IMF told Malawi to get rid of its strategic grain reserve in order to pay off the debt. So yes, the screws were put on to African countries in a big way. The one country that didn't buckle was Zambia. All other countries accepted the food as milled crops, so that although there couldn't be genetic pollution through the planting of the seed, the food safety concerns nonetheless remained, and they were basically badgered and beaten into submission, into accepting those genetically modified foods. The complaint that's going to be brought, that may or may not be brought to the World Trade Organization, really is about the European Union. The reason that the US is so keen to get rid of its, particularly its maize, as food aid, is because the markets for food aid, the markets for maize in Europe and Japan have dried up. Japan and Europe have said, well, actually, we don't want genetic modified food, thanks very much. And so the grain trade between the US and the EU has dried up, and they have these vast and growing surpluses. And that's why they're dumping it as food aid in the third world. Now, a complaint at the World Trade Organization would serve to eliminate those unfair moratoria. But the U.S. isn't just going to the World Trade Organization. And in fact, here's a plug for something else that folk can do. In California, in June, in Sacramento, the USDA, the USAID, and the State Department are inviting three cabinet-level ministers from every developing country to learn about the wisdom of biotechnology. And they're inviting them to something that's been called a ministerial summit and expo on biotechnology. This is meant to be an unbiased forum in which biotechnology can be debated, but just in case everyone decides that it is a good idea, there's an expo right next door. And that ministerial is going to happen June 23rd to 25th in Sacramento. It's a venue for precisely the same politics that you see at the World Trade Organization, where to essentially force developing countries to capitulate to a kind of regime where the U.S. is able to export its way, to export its subsidized commodities to the third world, and where the third world is forced to just suck it up. So if that riles you up, if that gets you angry about what the public government is doing, then write to lobby, write to your Congress people, write to your representatives, and come to Sacramento in June.
The third world plays an interesting role in the debate. It's sort of a shadow argument in the whole GMO debate, because the third world is also being used in the image of starvation that Roger was talking about earlier. It's being used to get us to accept GMOs also. And there are ads, and they're very clever and truly outrageous ads, that if we in the first world reject GMOs, we will be causing the starvation of people in the third world, because that is ultimately the great beneficiary of this technology. And that we have the luxury of saying no, because we have lots of food. But this is the salvation. This is the cure for world hunger. I would like to ask Raj whether he thinks there is any role for GMOs, either existing products or ones he could imagine, that might be helpful in the third world.
I don't know. I don't know what those roles. My imagination when it comes to these sorts of things is terribly limited. But I do know that there's, I mean, if the issue in the third world is not one of a shortage of production, and that's the line that's being taken at the moment by Monsanto and who have you, and it's precisely this myth of, well, if you don't let the third world have these crops, then yes, you are condemning them to starvation and certain death, and that seems to me precisely the wrong end of the stick. The reason people are starving in the third world is because of structural adjustment policies, is because of U.S. trade policy, is because of third world debt. These are the things that need to be changed in order to be able to feed people in the third world. About other issues, well, frankly, I'm agnostic. I mean, I think it could well be the case that some sort of that some sort of plant breeding, possibly genetically modified, though I have my suspicions, is good for the third world. But we don't know. Actually, we don't know. The science hasn't been done to be able to verify whether it's safe or not. And there's no point, to use the third world as a test bed for these sorts of technologies is craven and evil.
My comment is something like this. I actually grew a sunflower seed about 2 years ago, and it must have come from something, because not one of the seeds in that sunflower actually had a seed in it. There is no seed in that flower. Now that is what we're actually selling when you're actually selling GM stuff and selling that abroad. If you use that and it gets out, you're actually putting a gene called the terminator gene, which means that that seed is not going to produce fruit at the end of the day. That is what you're doing. And that is the escape possibilities, that you could actually basically sterilize all your food crops because these things are wind pollinated. So when you put out a wind pollinated gene, which is a terminator, which means that it will not produce viable seeds, is that you're going to create possibly, and actually quite likely, plants which will not be able to reproduce. That, I think, is the big reason why there's a big resistance in the third world countries, because what they do is they save their seeds to replant the next year. And what's happened in places like in here, the argument that's happening that the genetically modified seeds which are going down to Mexico, have been planted in Mexico, are not able to reproduce. And that's what's going to get into the actual area of most genetic diversity. And what we should be doing is, rather than minimizing our diversity, is increasing diversity. And what happens is that these big seed corporations are really interested in providing one thing. They're interested in getting a return market. They're interested in you having to buy your seeds this year, and then buy them again next year, and then again next year. That's what this is about, and this is what this control is about.
I agree that a lot of this technology is about control of the seed, but that's not new. I mean, we had that with hybrids. Hybrid corn presents the same ability to commodify the seed because you can't replant it. But the terminator. But we should make clear, the terminator technology is not now being commercialized, or it's not in the crops being sold right now. I don't believe so. Well, they're arguing in favor that the Terminator technology should be approved because now they're arguing on biosafety grounds, that it will keep genetic pollution from taking place, which is a very cynical argument. But that as far as I know, and last I checked, Monsanto still is not producing it. There is work being done on it. There's research being done, but it has not been commercialized. Last I checked.
Right.
A few more questions here, or last comments? There's a question over here. One at a time.
Thank you for enlightening us on the larger issues. What would you say, each of you, we could do in the next, say, 6 months as citizen consumers? What one thing would each of you say would be a step we could take to advance this knowledge and enlightenment?
Well, I think growing your own food is a great idea. It is the only way that you can assure it is what, you don't have to tell any stories about it. You'll know. You don't need any labels. So that is one thing. Grow a little bit of your own food. Another is, though, where you buy food, ask these questions. Where you buy coffee, ask, is this shade grown? I mean, that conversation, when I wrote this piece on beef last spring, there was suddenly a huge interest in grass-fed beef, and people didn't know there was such a thing, and that there was an alternative to this industrial corn-fed meat with all the problems that come with it. And somebody told me a story, and this story was in the Times. It had probably more impact in the Bay Area than anywhere else, oddly enough, or maybe not so oddly enough. And this woman mentioned to me a month or two later that she had gone into her butcher somewhere in Berkeley and said, is that meat grass-fed? And this guy is like, what is going on here? He'd been asked this question 10 times in the last month, and then he got grass-fed meat. And so that, you know, there is an effect. So asking questions of in Whole Foods, that's where you should ask, because they need to be pushed a little on this, because they're real minimalists on this kind of stuff. But I don't think they have grass-fed meat. They've got organic meat, which is still corn-fed meat. So ask a lot of questions. Be a pest in the produce section.
You could also support Alice Woman's schoolyard. It turns out that children in school who are exposed to organic food begin demanding the recipes at home, demanding that kind of food at home. And you start with kids, we're better.
Well, not only ask questions, I mean, that's obviously the first step, but I think that people need to actually, you know, buy the products that are produced ethically. It's, you know, it's a good idea to say, where is this from? And they, you know, is this produced ethically? And they say, I don't know. And you say, okay, you just buy it anyways. You know, take the time to go to the shops that do carry the products and make sure you buy those. I mean, you know, it's difficult sometimes to put in the extra effort, but I think ultimately it's worth it. You have to reward those shops that go out of their way to put those products out. If it costs a penny or two more or a little bit more, you know, you have to ask yourself, is it worth it? And I think the answer is yes. So you got to shop with your pocketbook.
It's also worth pointing out that these are usually better products, even from the narrowest point of view. They taste better. I mean, you can have your organic cake and eat it too. This is one area where we're doing the right thing is the tastier thing.
I guess, I mean, it depends on quite how militant one wants to be. I mean, a letter to your congressperson, I think, to your elected representatives, that says, firstly, that you don't approve of the war. Secondly, that you want third world debt cancelled, because third world debt is, I mean, the biggest stick with which third world governments are hit over the head. And thirdly, a decent incomes policy in the United States, a reconstruction of the welfare system. Well, I mean, not that there ever was a decent one here, but a social security system in the United States. So that it's not just the rich who can afford organic food. That letter is what I would urge y'all to write.
Question.
Oh, and I have something to add. I also work at Food First, and I also, another thing you can do, I want to invite you. We, in February, just did the largest delegation on sustainable agriculture of fact-finding and scientific people to Cuba to study the greatest model that have escaped, not for free, of course, because they went through famine with the boycott of the United States for a long time, but the most amazing sustainable agricultural model. And we are taking another delegation that we are going in May, and we're co-sponsoring the fifth organic agriculture conference. And although we have few spots left, you still can check it out. You can come. We usually don't take just the general public. We usually just take professionals. But in this case, because we are co-sponsoring the organic agriculture conference, we are taking just the public, as long as you work in something related to agriculture or sustainable development. And so please check out our website. This is in May 20th through the 31st, and you can check it out at foodfirst.org. Foodfirst.org, F-O-O-D, first.
I just wanted to make a brief comment regarding GMO foods and agribusiness in general. It's not uncommon to find the same researchers on the USDA board, EPA, they jump back and forth from their research institutions to the EPA, back to, there's a lot of incestuous relationships going on between research, private research and agribusiness.
Could you maybe speak towards that?
Well, I mean, there's the whole story of the approval of GMOs and how they're regulated is a story of Monsanto basically detailing its lawyers to go work in the, I think it was the FDA, for the period during which the regulations were written, and then come back to Monsanto. It was a very blatant, there was a lot of historical serendipity, too. GMOs came to the market in America, or came to the approval process, at a very interesting time. Dan Quayle had been put in charge of regulations. Enough said. And so they were very, very lightly regulated. And essentially, it was a voluntary system of regulation. But then the Clinton administration had a chance, when they came in, to have some input into the regime that would regulate this. The Clinton administration was very supportive of biotechnology. The Democratic Party, this was that moment when the economy was kind of flailing in the early 80s and... in the early 90s, and at the end of the first Bush administration. And the Democratic Party had something you don't hear about anymore called industrial policy, and they were gonna pick certain industries to support and really get behind. And the Democrats got strongly behind biotechnology, and Monsanto was very close to the Clinton administration and gave them a lot of money and served on a lot of panels for them. So the case of GMOs in this country is a case of, in America, whenever both political parties are on the same side of an issue, there are no politics, and there's no space, there's no debate. And that was true of GMOs, and there never would have been any debate over it except for the fact that in the global system, what Europeans think matters, and what other countries think matters. And one of the, I think one of the great ironies of globalization and world trade is that politics can pop up in surprising places. And so it was really the objections of the Europeans that started some politics around GMOs in this country. But it's never taken hold electorally. There is one congressman who's been trying to push, Dennis Kucinich has been trying to push labeling bills, and it's been it's amazing. He cannot get co-sponsors for a labeling bill. I mean, a right to know, a consumer information bill. So it's kind of hopeless in Washington on that issue.
Well, there's one question way in the back.
Oh,
you're still up? Yeah. Wait for the microphone.
I don't know if it has any answer, but my question was just the European-American divide on this issue, as on so many other things, is it an issue of PR in terms of this, or what are the substantive factors that are affecting these issues as far as perception of food security and the broader issues that you see at root? In this situation, how can we become more like the Europeans? I guess is what I'm asking.
How can we become more like the Europeans? Well, you can speak to this. I mean, there's a very different tradition of very different attitudes toward regulation. There are a couple arguments you hear. I mean, one argument you hear is it's just protectionism, that they want to protect their agriculture. Another argument you hear is that they're much more distrustful of their regulators because of things like mad cow disease. That the American consumer is, in general, if the FDA signs off on something, they're pretty content. We have a lot of trust in the FDA, or we have had. So that's another argument. But then there's also, a tradition of people are closer to the farm still, also in Europe. Agriculture hasn't been quite as industrialized. Farms are not quite so far away from people's experience. A higher percentage of the population still farms. And there is a culture of food. I mean, and the purity of food and the provenance of food is a very important part of, certainly in Italy and France, of the culture. And that makes something like GMOs more suspect. The fact that they also come from America has also made them more suspect. You know, for the French, it's part and parcel of all the other things we bring to their culture they don't like. So there are many, many threats here to their objection.
So
I can, you know, just speaking about the coffee issue, and you know, he mentioned protectionism. The fair trade coffee and these kind of movements are so far ahead in Europe than they are here, and they're not really growing the coffee in Europe either. So it's not a question of protectionism. It's, you know, I don't know. Why do the Europeans care more about other people than, say, the Americans do, and are concerned about, you know, how the farmers are treated or how the environment is treated? It's a good question. I don't know how we can get the Americans to, I don't know. I mean, it sounds good on a simple level. I don't know. I think the Europeans, maybe they care more about other countries and other peoples, and they don't have this monolithic attitude of, you know, we're Americans, we do it all, and we know we're only concerned about ourselves. You know, the market has to be unregulated at all costs. I don't know. I think that there's just different traditions there that we don't have here. And I think ideas that develop over there, you know, do make their way over here and vice versa. But, you know, I think that eventually, you know, I think that we're taking the right steps, but I don't have an easier answer for that.
But, well, I mean, there are things that one can do. I mean, one of the reasons that the GM scare, the GM fear in Europe has been quite so potent is because there is a very well-developed consumers movement. And in the United States, you have the Consumers Union, which, oddly enough, on this issue at least, is being very militant. I mean, it's being very militant. It's being it has one of the best scientists. Mike Hansen is his name, who is, you know, continually baiting Monsanto and USDA. So providing your support to their organization and disseminating their information, this is the Consumers Union, which I think you can reach at consumersunion.org, is one way of actually becoming more European insofar as you're mobilizing that consumer movement or increasing the power of consumer choice within the U.S.
Our time is up, and I'd like to ask if there are any last comments or concluding remarks from the panelists.
Stop the war.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming.
You watch it now?
Yeah.